Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
So good evening and welcome to the Midweek Takeaway. Tonight we're joined by the CEO of Valorix, Susie Dilley. How are you today, Susie?
I'm very good, Phil. Thank you.
So obviously we saw the news this week of the signing of the letter of intent to sublicense Val201 to it's hard to pronounce it, Theorem RX. There's always an RX on the end of something, isn't there? So can you tell us more about the potential deal and what it actually means for the company going forward and also for investors?
Yeah, so the deal with Theorem RX, and I'll make sure everybody knows how to pronounce that properly by the end of this, it's one of the biggest items of news we've had in Valorix's history, certainly this year, possibly forever. This is the first signature on the sublicensing deal for Val201. So as we say, it's the first signature. So this is a signature of a letter of intent. Now, I know that there's been a few questions about why announce a non-binding agreement to start with. But we wanted to be completely upfront and transparent with all of our shareholders at the earliest possible moment. So I think when I was talking to you a couple of weeks ago, I said we will be announcing the first signature. So actually, that's a bit of an exaggeration because it's not just one signature on a piece of paper. It's the signature of us, of Theorem RX, and of course of Cancer Research Technology, who we've licensed the program from in the first place. So three signatures on one piece of paper takes a bit longer to organise than just one. This is quite usual that a letter of intent gets signed first in a deal. It allows them to go out and show their investors that they have got this lined up, that we're not going to go and sell it to somebody else in the meantime, and lets them commit the legal resources to making sure the documents are in place to sign up for the full sublicense at the appropriate time.
So do you want to tell us a little bit more about Theorem RX in terms of who they are? I mean, I know there's been a few web sleuths who've been trying to search down, having a look on Google, saying they're a one-man band outfit. Can you give us a bit more about their credentials, please?
I have to admit, I've been watching the Google sleuthing, and that's kept me chuckling for a while. I think one person has actually found the correct Ken Sorensen, so congratulations. I'm not going to name who it is, but I think I saw him on Zoom, if he uses the same Zoom name as LSE. Ken Sorensen was obviously named on the RNS. He's, as somebody has found through the power of Google, he is a patent attorney in the US. He's been a research scientist in the past. He's been involved in a number of biotech deals before. And he's the guy for finance for Theorem RX. There is also a scientist, or actually two scientists, one of whom is a prostate cancer specialist, the other of whom is a peptide specialist. So I think that they are a really rather good team to take Val201 forwards, particularly for the prostate cancer side. They've all worked in various places around the world, in the UK as well as in the US. At the moment, they're half US-based, half Canada-based. And then the fourth member of the team there that we've met so far is more of the operations guy, the person who does the commercial and the legal work. So it looks like a very coherent team. They have some very detailed science plans. They've certainly asked all the right scientific questions and done quite a lot of digging and quite a lot of interrogating about us over the last day. I was going to say 6 months, but it's gone on for a little bit longer than that now, probably about 9 months since we first spoke to them. So most of this year, we've been back and forth with pretty much weekly calls with them. First of all, negotiating science, looking at exactly what we've done, why we've done it, what the real details of the science are, and what the opportunities and potential markets are. And then leading on from potential markets to what the potential deals are around it. So this is highly negotiated on both the science and the commercial side. And we know exactly what their plans are going forwards as well. So that's what's really exciting about this.
And what sort of audience do they have in terms of funders and backers for funding these operations?
Well, being US-based, they have a whole different world of funding opportunities to us. I mean, I think certainly when I was first starting out in the biotech world 15 years ago, people always said, well, go to the US, you can have a zero on the value of everything. And I always used to think that was a bit of a joke. And I think maybe it's not quite as true as it used to be. But certainly the world of financing and early stage biotech financing is very different over there to over here. So they're talking to private funding groups, whether that's family offices or private equity. They certainly have quite a lot of ideas of of where to get money from. We will be carrying out due diligence on their potential investors, as well as them carrying out due diligence on us over this next period.
Okay. So as part of the same RNS, it was stated that Valorix would perform consulting services to Theorem Rx in the form of a technology, etc. So can you talk us through what that means in terms of revenues or income to Valorix going forward?
Yeah, so normally when you approach a deal of this sort, you would have a period of technology transfer in order to make sure that all of the history and all of the techniques that are known about the project transfer across smoothly, and there's no hiccups when you transfer across. Now, this is a little bit more than that, because this actually provides for us to actively provide services for around 2 years in order to support their further development of the programme. So this isn't just making sure that they do the science right. This is them recognising that we have some skills and we can provide some liaison to UK clinical sites, for example, in order to make sure everything runs in the best possible way. So we're looking for that to be a very active part of the deal. I almost said collaboration there, but it is a sub-licensing deal and not a joint venture or collaboration. We are going to be under a service agreement, which will be a standard consultancy agreement for my time and the time of any of our staff or advisors that we want to put into it in exchange for cold hard cash. And that will be cash coming in on a monthly basis. We hope for that to start before year end. And certainly I've already been working with the scientist in quite a lot of detail about exactly what we're going to do for that. Although we're not going to put a number on exactly the money that's going to be coming in, because that's probably going to vary month to month, depending on how much time needs to be spent on it, it's clearly going to be showing up in our accounts quite quickly. So it's going to be clear to everyone when it starts coming in.
You could say it's a significant revenue for working to help working capital and keep the company.
Oh, absolutely. It pay a salary. It's that kind of level.
Yeah.
So we're certainly not going to be losing by me spending time on it, let's put it that way.
Yeah, of course. So obviously the market reaction was very interesting yesterday. You know, to open up, I watched it open at 65 and obviously thought, you know, it's one of those, you know, it hit the ground running. And then obviously to see the sudden drop and a massive sell-off was obviously concerning for everybody. Do you think that the market is erring on the side of caution on the fact that due diligence still needs to be completed there before anything's, you know, confirmed indefinitely?
It's quite possible that's the reason. It's always hard to tell with these things. I mean, I know shareholders don't like it when I say I can never predict which way a share price is going to go based on the news. I find it quite funny when we get asked by the Nomad or by regulators, have you got any inside information that could affect the share price? I said, I've got inside information. I don't know which direction it's going to make the share price go in. So yes, it's possible. And I guess we'll see, won't we, in a few weeks' time and those final contracts are signed and the due diligence is complete. If everything does go to plan and everything gets signed on schedule, then clearly we'll announce that as well. And we'll have to see whether or not that reassures everyone and puts us back to or higher than where we were. And clearly, as I've just said, I would never make a share price prediction because it's a finger in the air for me. I leave it to you experts at predicting share prices.
Experts? I don't think there's any experts in this room.
I think you've been following the markets a lot longer than I have. I think if I do science and build value, as in valuable science into a company, that the company value will go up. And I believe that if I build commercial deals into a company that show that money's going to come in, then I assume the value of the company will go up. So ultimately, hopefully that will come to bear. But as we say, we have to just see where the market forces take us.
Yeah, what really hit home to me yesterday when we were speaking with you briefly yesterday evening is that Val is a company, and yes, its end game is to be worth more than it was the day before or more than it is now for the future for the shareholders. But I saw it come through in what you were saying, that actually it's very important to you that these drugs or potential drugs actually do have an impact on people who have cancer. So, you know, there's a real human side to this. You've been involved in this for a long time, and you even said, I think, in your previous interview, that part of this was for stuff you did at university and your PhD and so on and so forth. there is a real human side to this as well. So would you like to comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's always a really careful balancing act, because on the one hand, I am a scientist at heart. I'm driven by the desire to do good science, to understand science better, and to be able to apply that understanding to something actually really practical and useful. So actually making drugs that are going to make people feel better. And that's something I think when we were speaking last time, I explained that I went to university to do medicinal pharmaceutical chemistry specifically because I wanted a purpose behind the study. Everyone wanted me to go into maths. I thought, well, great, I could do maths if I wanted to. But doing medicinal pharmaceutical chemistry, not just pure chemistry, there's a point to it. There's an end goal. I can make drugs that are going to make people feel better out of this. But then of course, as a company, we're here to make money for our shareholders. We're here to run the company in the best way for shareholders. And there is the balance. There's a balance between doing good science, but then there's also the balance of ethical considerations for the patients as well. And that's long-term for the patients, but also for the patients in the clinical trials. And I think I've spoken quite a lot over the last year about how I'm not sure that AIM is the right place for a company to be running a single clinical trial, because clinical trials, you have to protect the patient's welfare. You can't be having constant and constant hype around it, because that's going to impact the patients who are actually on the trial at the time. So that's why we've focused on this niche of the preclinical in the future. But in the meantime, we've got these couple of really great assets which are already in clinical development that we can now pass on to people to do the next stage of development, allowing that cash from those deals to come back in order to fund what I think we'll be really good at, which is that preclinical translation piece, to get projects to a stage where it's appropriate for somebody to take it into clinical trials.
And yeah, that's basically the point that we were coming back to, that Vial is a different animal than it was a year or a year and a half ago, because ultimately these are legacy issues or legacy deals that are going to be going out and hopefully being very prosperous in terms of what comes back. So on that point, the question I would ask is, you mentioned in the RNS that there is one, if one happens, it's $61 million. But is it likely, from a medical perspective, that there will be many different uses for 201?
Yeah, so I mean, that's quite an interesting question, because as I've highlighted, TheoremRx is a team that has a prostate cancer specialist in it in particular. So we are very clear that it's 95% likely that prostate cancer is going to be their first choice of disease indication to go into. But scientifically, yes, there is rationale for this to go into other cancer types as well. And in fact, we even had that in our trial protocol for the phase 1-2 clinical trial that we completed last year, in that we had the opportunity to go into other solid tumor types in the protocol where a rationale existed scientifically. So this could mean, because it's the mechanism of action is along the pathway where hormone-stimulated cancer cell growth is impacted. This isn't just androgen hormone, so testosterone, this is also estrogen driven. So where there's estrogen stimulated cancer cell growth, this also has an opportunity to impact those cancer types. So we're talking ovarian, endometrial, breast, any of those female cancers have potential to be treated by VAR201. So obviously, it'd be great if TheoremRx went for those. But actually, even if they don't, because they're looking to take this through to a further stage in clinical development, and then they'll look for a partner to carry out the commercialization and final market authorization processes. And at that stage, that final partner may choose to broaden the scope as well, and we'll still benefit at that point if they do. So that option is there throughout the time of the sublicense. And that opportunity could come back and benefit us at any point. So it's very exciting. We're very pleased to have sneaked that bit in there because it's something that looks quite innocuous, but actually could have quite a major impact if it turns out to be relevant.
Okay, great. Thanks, Susie. So I'm gonna ask you some of these questions that we've been given. because they sound a lot more intelligent than my questions probably, but let's give them a go and see what you come up with. So the first question, what royalties will 201 attract per indication on commercialization? I will send you the crystal ball now, and
that's not a crystal ball question, but I'm afraid it's going to remain a crystal ball question for everyone on this call, because clearly the commercially sensitive terms that weren't in the IRS.
I think many investors don't understand that when you get down to the nitty gritty of these deals, you cannot put to market. It's just all commercially sensitive information. So unfortunately, we're not going to. I mean, it may come out in the wash, as you say, just like some of these, the revenue incentives and the consultancy charges eventually will come out in financials. But you'll never find out the real deals on the commercial side of things. But
no, it's something we'll certainly talk to the regulators and talk to TheoremRx and CRT, who are obviously involved as well, about what further information can be put out when the final deal is signed. But certainly at this stage, anything beyond the headline numbers, if you put it out now, they might decide to renegotiate during the due diligence procedure. They can find something and say, oh, well, we didn't know about that. We're going to chop that in half just because you mentioned it publicly.
Yeah.
It's expected to be mid to high single figures. So it's a pretty standard sort of deal.
I'll ask this question, but do you think yesterday's price action was justified? And how do you plan to reverse it?
Well, my answer to how to make the share price go up, I've definitely already answered. We're building value into the company through science and commercial arrangements. The long-term strategy of the company is to be much larger than we are at the moment. We intend to do this by bringing new programs in, as well as by out-licensing the legacy programs that we have. So some of that's going to be more visible more quickly than other bits. And certainly we've also talked about our strategy of looking to potentially expand our capacity by developing some early stage technology platforms or acquiring some early stage technology platforms to bring in-house and expand our offering, in particular to make sure that we can facilitate developments for treatments for diseases of women's health and making sure that we can get women into early stage clinical trials, even where it's not necessarily a women's health condition. We believe we can help that to happen across the board by developing technology platforms in that area. So all of this is about building a coherent company, about making an integrated company that can offer services to the wider industry and bring more revenues while developing our own in-house pipeline of drugs, which is going to create value because it's an actual thing that's going to be in the pipeline. And then, of course, out-licensing out those bits of pipeline, whether or not they're legacy assets we already have or the ones that we're bringing through. So long term, we have a lot of plans and strategies around value creation, around building the company and really making this something that people will recognise as a fully functioning, integrated biotech company.
Okay, we didn't write this next question. How important will PR be going forward and will this be addressed?
I think that's your PR company who's written that question. Just
No. We didn't. I promise you, we didn't.
So everybody knows that we're keen on shareholder communication. We want to make our shareholder communication as open and transparent as possible, making myself available at reasonably short notice. So obviously, it's actually you making yourselves available on short notice. But just making sure people know that we're out here. We want to talk to people. Even when we've had a day like yesterday, making sure that doesn't mean we're going to hide from people. Of course it's not. We want to make sure that shareholders hold us to account for everything that we do. We're proud of the deal that we've done and that we've announced the letter of intent for this week. We want people to know that. We're not going to be defensive about it. So the PR is about improving communications. And there's a lot of different aspects to that. So obviously your aspect is working great because I'm here talking to you tonight. Yeah. And then there's that more, I'm going to probably insult people on the call, the more institutional investors, I was going to say sophisticated, but the more institutional investors are then handled by our brokers, IR departments.
Will Senko's have a very visible presence over the next few months?
I think very visible has different meanings to different people. So they will be more visible to retail as well as institutional investors when they start writing break notes and those sorts of activities. But I believe that they will have already made Valerix more visible to some people already. It's just not necessarily the people who will be on this call, because it's very much different audiences see different things and different audiences want to see different details. So there's quite often in the age of the internet that there is a massive opening that's put out for one audience is going to be picked up by everyone. However, where Senkos have approached people separately, that wouldn't necessarily have been visible to retail investors. So I have complete faith in what they're doing already, not just what they are going to do in the future.
Okay, very good. Okay, so there's a couple more questions. Does the deal give us funding for the foreseeable future?
Now, I used the word foreseeable future in my interview with BRI yesterday, and I got slapped over the wrist by the finance director for that, because he asked me whether or not I had a crystal ball that could see more than the next millisecond into the future, because clearly I can't. So I have to find a word that doesn't quite say that. But certainly we already had working capital covered until the middle of next year anyway. I don't think there's many AIM companies who have been publishing their bank balance openly every quarter for the last year in the way that we have, in order to reassure people that we have broken the cycle of placings after placings purely for working capital purposes. So I can categorically state that, and again, I'll probably get slapped on the wrist tomorrow for this, working capital is absolutely fine. As I say, we had it to the middle of next year anyway, with the money coming in, hopefully from Theorem Rx. On top of that, that certainly expands the runway for another year or so after that. Clearly, if there's something that we want to spend money on that isn't working capital, i.e. if there is just that irresistible technology platform that we need to build out the company and build the larger, more integrated company we're looking for, then that's a different question. And clearly we would have to approach shareholders about that and see what you think about it, see whether or not you agree with us that would be very much value accretive to the company. But it's certainly not going to be a working capital fundraiser for the Christmas party.
Do they have any, have they expressed any interest or potentially could express interest in 301 and 401? I think is one of the questions that we sort of skirted around.
Yeah, so 301 is the same peptide as 201. It's but in the non-oncology indication of endometriosis. So obviously, because we talked to them about the peptide and the science behind the peptide and our license from CRT, Cancer Research UK, covers both. It covers the actual composition of matter pattern. So it covers anything we do with the peptide. And we talked about it. It was part of the negotiation. So we sort of said, we'll pay a bit more, we can have this as well. Not quite buy one, get one free, but it's always part of the negotiation to see what else you can put in for what extra money. In the end, we decided that it would be far more interesting to us to keep it. The conversation wasn't going in a way that made it more valuable to us to put it in with the deal. So we decided we would carve it out separately. And it is something that we would like to develop further. It's squarely in our area of expertise in women's health. There clearly is a need for new treatments of endometriosis. And we see that when we're talking to potential partners for that program all the time. And it is clearly in the preclinical space that we are trying to build our pipeline out in. So actually, although if somebody does want to take it off our hands or does want to partner it at the moment, particularly with the work we're doing in conjunction with the Japanese pharma company at the moment, that would be great. However, we are also developing it and doing further research on it ourselves at the moment as well.
Can you confirm why you are so confident that the first payment will be this year and how much are Val likely to get in consultation fees from the company going forward? Okay, so you've answered the second part already.
That's what I was going to say. So the reason we put the time frame on the RNS is because there are time frames in the letter of intent. So there are clear timelines that say they expect their due diligence to take X amount of time. We added a bit more time onto it in order to allow for Thanksgiving and Christmas, and came up with a number that still gives us a little bit of clearance before year end. So I had a chat with our nomad, had a chat with Theorem RX, and said, well, look, I want to put a timeline in the RNS because I want people to be clear that this isn't an open-ended arrangement. This isn't just a go away and try anything you like and maybe eventually agree to give us some money. This is a genuine letter of intent that says you have a set period of exclusivity where you can do due diligence. At the end of that period, either you walk away or you buy it. And obviously, with Thanksgiving and Christmas in the way, there will be a little bit of leeway on that. That our intention is that this is defined and this is stated as such because that's what we expect to happen. That's what's written into the agreements and that's what we've scheduled. And trust me, they've already started the due diligence list over the last couple of days. So while I've certainly not been trying to dodge shareholders, I may have been not receiving all the emails I might have been as quickly as I should be.
So is there any payment if they walk away?
That would depend on whether or not the service agreement is already signed. So because the service agreement is signed separately from the letter of intent and those kinds of things, we've got an opportunity to get that started sooner because I am already doing some work on their behalf. So it would be on the service agreement side rather than any payments from licensing.
I'm sure that the existing holders and legacy holders of the company will agree that since you've come on board, you've certainly turned the fortunes of the company around, and I'm sure that they're very grateful of the position they're in, that you know they're in, and that you're in right now. So, CEO of Valoric, Susie Dilley, thanks very much.
Thank you for inviting me on, Phil and Kevin.
Cheers.
Thank you.